Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, we've got something that we've been talking about for quite a while now. I know that we in, I think it was our self-driving cars from CES episode, we hinted that I had received a book for Christmas that was of automotive legends and mysteries and myths. And I've got that book sitting in front of me right now. And we had said that we wanted to talk about a couple of different stories in this thing, if not every story that's in this book. And we're going to hit one of those today.
Yes. From the book, Automotive Mysteries, Myths, and Rumors Revealed. Wow. That was my rural juror moment.
Close enough.
Okay. We're going to talk about a car that some people may not have heard of. The Norseman.
Yeah, that's right. This is a there's a good reason why a lot of people may not have heard about this thing, because it wasn't around for too long. There's an entire legend around this thing, and just to kind of point out how this book is laid out that we're following
Sure.
here for this information. We've gone elsewhere for info as well, but this really lays it out cleanly and concisely. This book does. The legend is, and it'll wrap up with the verdict at the end. But the Norseman. Legend is that it's a famous Chrysler concept car that sunk to the bottom of the ocean aboard the Andrea Doria, which is a cruise liner in the the mid-1950s.
And it's right outside of Nantucket.
Exactly. And is that or is not that not true? Because, you know, there's often this mention of this Chrysler Norseman concept vehicle, which is called an idea car at the time.
Yeah.
Did it or did it not exist? And what are the details about this car? So let's dig into it.
Yeah. So when we talk about this car, let's see. If we want to follow a rough timeline, we'll be talking about a couple of different players here. What's interesting about the Norseman is that it is kind of collaborative between a collaboration between Chrysler and a little company called Ghia.
Yeah, Ghia is it's an Italian coach builder in, I think it's Genoa, Italy. Is that right?
They were started in 1915 in Turin, and they eventually were absorbed by Ford.
Okay, so it's somewhere in Italy. It's an Italian design house. Mm-hmm. And Ghia, it's not the first time that they had worked with Chrysler on a project. In fact, Ghia had worked with other manufacturers as well. I think they put together the Lincoln Futura as well.
Yes.
Another car that we'll talk about in a moment.
Yeah, I was going to say it's important, folks. Remember that.
It is important, yes. But this goes all the way back to – let's just start the this timeline. How about this? We've got a rough – timeline, or do you have other things you'd like to cover first?
Well, no, you know what? Let's go ahead and dive in. We're starting in the early 50s, right?
Yeah, 1953.
Okay.
And that's when the work starts, I guess, when the idea is hatched and the plans are kind of finalized and, you know, it's in progress, I guess, is the best way to put it, in 1953. Now, by 1954, the project, which, you know, this titled the Norseman at this point, was handed over to a guy named Bill Brownlee. And it was handed over by someone who was well-known at Chrysler, and in fact, well-known in the automotive industry in general, Virgil Exner.
Yes, Virgil Exner, born in 1909 and passed away in 1973. During his time, he became a world-renowned, I think it's fair to say, designer and stylist. He worked for GM. He worked with Studebaker. But he really started to shine at Chrysler, and he's the one who called them idea cars instead of concept cars.
Yeah, and he was hired by Chrysler to kind of jumpstart their design department, their style department. Because if you look at the Chryslers of the 1950s, the early 1950s, late 1940s, they had started to fall behind in the design area. They were not on the cutting edge like they wanted to be. And so they hired Exner, and that's exactly what he was doing, especially with this Norseman, which, by the way, the Norseman was named because Exner had, a Norwegian heritage.
Yeah, Norwegian-American.
Yeah, so it all makes sense that, you know, he decided we're going to call this, you know, project the Norseman, and it's going to be, my greatest project for 1956, 1957, that era. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, Scott, I do want to go back just a little bit.
Yeah, we have to go back to 54 and 55 still, really.
Right, there's been some work with Ghia on some concepts, the C200 concept, the Chrysler K310, the DeSoto Adventurer. So they were building a relationship, these two companies, and they were really beginning to find their stride. I want to be completely honest with you here, buddy. I'm excited to talk about the car's features and the reason it was called the most automated car.
I'm totally excited about
this
car.
And I know we need to set it up.
We'll get to it, I promise, because I've got some features as well that I think are really, really cool about this thing. I'm sure we share the same list because there's not a whole lot known about this car, really.
Yeah, there's not too much, but we do have this rough timeline. We should stick to it.
Okay, so we're back in 1954. The project is handed off to this Bill Brownlee and by Virgil Exner and another guy named who was the Chrysler styling chief at the time, named Cliff Voss.
Yes.
Okay, so they hand this off to Brownlee, and he develops this in what they call the Imperial Studio at Chrysler. Mm. And the thing about this is they actually built models of this car here in the United States. And this is in 1955 when all this is happening here. But the scale models, you know, the clay models that they built or, you know, wood or whatever they were, they never left the Highland Park, Michigan facility. And I can't go beyond this point, Ben, without just taking a little tiny sidebar here. Do you remember back when I told you about that former boss of mine that, you know, we had both worked at Highland Park for a short time?
Yeah.
Both of us had. And he had mentioned he'd take walks and find, you know, corridors underground that led to places with doorways and everything?
Yes, yes.
Do you remember when I mentioned that he had found, you know, scale model cars in these rooms?
Yeah.
And drawings?
No way. Are you serious?
I don't know. I mean, how would I know that? I mean, he never took photos. He never, you know, did anything like that because it was a long time ago. You didn't just have a digital camera.
You think he could have found
you.
It, though, the legendary
maybe he found
models of the Norseman?
He might have found a scale model of it. Who knows? I mean, they were there. They existed, and they never left Highland Park. So if it was something that they felt, you know, that they needed to hold on to, it's very possible that he walked in on a room that had a scale model of this Norseman. It's neat to think about.
That is so cool.
So, okay,
man.
Back to the original story here.
Right.
The scale model car never left Highland Park, Michigan. So how is a company in Italy – remember, this is 1953.
Right.
How are they going to get the exact detailed information of the car, the vehicle, to them? Well, they used engineering drawings, which you'd think would be great, but there's something to being able to see the finished product right in front of you.
Yes, because there's a much more intuitive understanding, I would argue, of the space and the proportion, which makes this – Scott, I believe you were saying this off air, the first car, right, to be created entirely by engineering drawings.
Well, between these two.
Between these
two companies. Between GEA and Chrysler, it was created by strictly engineering drawings. There was no scale model that they had to look at and say, this is what we want to end up with. They fortunately, I guess, the translation, you know, between Chrysler and GEA worked out really well because the model came along perfect. I mean, they would send photos along the way of progress.
And they had time to mail those photos because this car was not built quickly.
No.
They went with a slow and steady wins the race sort of approach. It took them 15 months, so more than a year. And it was running late, which is important to our story.
It's a complex design.
It's a complex design. And remember, they're working off of drawings. This was at a cost, I believe, of let's see, the currency in Italy at the time, lira, 50 million.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds like an awful lot. I would guess, can I take a guess on this? And I thought I read it somewhere, so maybe I'm not totally guessing, but I want to guess that that's somewhere in the neighborhood of like $200,000, $250,000 U.S. dollars, something like that. That's approximate for what a concept vehicle, a dream car in the 1950s, early 1950s cost. Now, you'd have to, that's not current dollars. That's not 2013 dollars. So you'd have to extrapolate that out to, you know, what inflation has done to that. But $250,000 in 1953 was a heck of a lot of money.
Well, I've got a calculation here, too.
Oh,
because,
you do? I went into all that description. Okay.
I don't want to interrupt
how
you.
How wrong was I?
You were completely on board with the concept. A Chrysler spokesperson, after the calamity occurred, a Chrysler spokesperson pegged the cost at around $150,000. He said it was insured, so there's that.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, and so we ran the inflation calculator the way we like to do whenever there's a cost entered back in the golden days. So what cost $150,000 in 1956? Mm-hmm. I know I'm jumping the timeline here. You ready?
Ready.
All right. Let's see. 1.2, just under $1.25 million.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot of money, even now. That's still a lot of money. I mean, that's, I wonder how that compares to modern day concept vehicles. If they truly cost, you know, a little over $1 million, or if they're more in like the $10 million range.
Right. Know? 15 months, $1.25 million. Let's just round it up. And then they are late with it, which is, you know, not abnormal when you're making a brand new car. But what did they get for that?
Well, see, they had this is an amazing car, really. I mean, this is like, I mean, I guess I've got a whole list of things that we can go through kind of quickly if you want.
Absolutely.
But, okay, so we talked about the collaboration. We talked about, you know, how this thing kind of was passed down between management at Chrysler and who went to Ghia. It was scheduled, the Norseman was scheduled to make the rounds at the 1957 auto show circuit. So this was going to be, for the following year, early on. They needed it, you know, ahead of time to get it ready and everything, but it was already running late. Oh, by the way, I'm already off on another. How cool would it be, just mentioning the 1957 auto show circuit, how cool would it be to go back and look at the 1957 auto show circuit right now, if you knew now what you didn't know then, you know?
Oh man, yes.
I just can't imagine. I mean, I look at photos and, you know, they're just not detailed enough for me, I guess. You know, I'd love to get the full walk around of every vehicle. That'd be incredible.
Let's go a little bit further in this tangent, because I read recently a book by Stephen King about time travel. Mm-hmm. And the novel is about a guy who wants to travel back in time to prevent the assassination of Kennedy.
Hmm. Okay.
And when he goes back, you know, this is the 60s, right? When he goes back, one thing that I became obsessed with reading that, now, you know, as Stephen King gets older, his novels are just getting longer. So I have plenty of time to think about this. I was thinking about the exact same kind of stuff, Scott. Can you imagine going back as a time traveler to car shows? Oh man, and all you need is some currency of the time and then just buy them and hide them in a barn that you know will still be there in 2015.
Some type of underground bunker or something, you know, that you'd be able to retrieve them, you know, 50 years later. That would set your future, you know.
This is my foolproof scheme.
All right, so we keep getting derailed here. Let's get back to it. So the main point here, and I guess, you know, we'll get into the features in just one second here because it comes up right now. But this was a fully operational, drivable car, which was really unique at the time, because most of these dream cars
are just sort of bodies.
Exactly. Yeah, they would just push them out on stage, and there was a reason behind that. They had the, you know, the ability to add an engine, transmission, and the full driveline. Oftentimes, the radical designs would lead them to, you know, places that they wouldn't fit. You know, this was designed with the idea that we're gonna put this specific motor in it, this specific transmission in it, and it's going to operate. It's going to be a running driving car. Like who was it? I want to say Harley Earl, was that it?
Mm.
Also Bill Mitchell.
Oh, you know, those guys. Are you talking about the great designers?
Yeah, they would build cars that, you know, ran and operated, of course. But for this one to be fully operational, that was still pretty unique for the day.
And let's also consider that because it's that unique. I don't mean to run over you here, Scott.
No, don't.
Because this is a working model, this is a strong indication, albeit circumstantial, a strong indication that had this chain of events occurred differently, we would have seen a production model incorporating a lot of this.
Nice.
Or some of it.
Nicely,
you know what
stated.
I mean?
Yeah, very good. Let's just get into the features then, because one of the things that this thing had that maybe is, I don't know, the most standout visual feature.
And my least favorite part.
Really? A frameless windshield.
The frameless windshield.
Yeah,
cantilevered roof.
It is. It's a cantilevered roof that attaches only at the back. Like, imagine where the C-pillar would be.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cantilevered to the front. There's really no structural support at the A-pillar other than, I guess there were...
There's the windshield.
Well, there's the windshield, and as Virgil Exner explained, Exner Jr., later explained, there were actually 2 quarter-inch diameter steel rods that held the roof in place at the front, but not in the way that you think. This is really strange. Instead of holding the roof up, the 2 quarter-inch rods held the roof down. There was upward tension on the roof from the back. So if there was a rollover to occur, the rods would snap and then the roof would spring upward instead of crushing downward.
It would spring up and back.
Up and back instead of crushing downward, which is kind of, that's a pretty interesting design,
I guess.
So the rods didn't hold the roof up, they held the roof down.
The front rods, the rear pillars were the primary support.
I don't know if that changes your mind about it at all. I mean, I think it looks cool.
Yeah, it does look cool, but there are no vent windows.
A lot of people think that design would have sagged, which is not the case. And if anything, it would have pulled up.
Yeah, that does make me feel a little bit better about it, but still, it's not my favorite thing. But
you're mentioning the windows, right?
While we're on the roof, I want to talk about, yes, it does look really cool, the frameless curved windshield. Mm-hmm. But even cooler, there are so many features in this car. While we're on the roof, let's talk about the electrically operated sunroof.
Ah, yeah, that's
which
really
is
cool.
Just crazy for this time in history.
And it was big.
It was big.
It was a huge sunroof. I mean, if you look at the roof photo of this thing, and there's very few photos really.
Right.
But if you do look at the roof photo of this thing, the sliding portion of it opens up completely. I mean, it was like a panoramic view, you know. It was enormous.
Yeah.
And it was such a thin roof design, it made it really stand out. I mean, it's pretty incredible design for the day.
It's bold, you know?
Very.
And let's see, they also had, well, the engine, let's just talk about that. 235 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad, right? That's a Hemi V8.
Not bad, I guess.
Not bad, you guess.
Yeah, well, you know, they had other options.
They did. What would you put in there?
Well, they mentioned that, you know, they think that eventually it would have had the high output version of that engine, which would have been something like, I think it was like around 340 horsepower, something like that.
Yeah.
So it could have really been stepped up there.
Right. Okay.
235, I guess. I mean, we'll talk about the specs here if you want, because it's a big car.
All right. So it's got 2-speed power flight transmission. The chassis probably comes from the Chrysler 300 series. Interestingly enough, Scott, in Chrysler's official press releases and stuff, they called the V8 a 331 CI polyspheric V8.
Ah, that's a Hemi engine, right?
Yeah, it's a Hemi.
That's a Hemi engine.
It's a Hemi engine.
So that thing had a Hemi.
And it had a single 4-barrel carburetor.
Okay, got it. You want to know the length and width and all that good
stuff?
Because when you said 235, that sounds like that's a decent amount for the day, right?
Right.
But when you consider that this car was just under 19 feet long, it was 7 feet wide, Ben. This is a long, wide vehicle and about 4.5 feet tall. It was the second longest of the Chrysler IDEA cars of that era.
And so, only have 4 seats.
I know. But you know, that's really cool too. The interior design, you can see in some of the interior photos, that, you know, the interior design was really, really interesting too. The rear bucket seats almost. Okay, so we keep getting off track here.
Oh, it also had hidden headlights.
Hidden headlights that completely disappeared when the lights were off. It had fully electric power seats. I don't know if you mentioned that or not.
Oh, no, good call.
And you started to mention about the door glass vent. Now, that's the little triangle vent at the front that some people really love, some people don't like it. I love it.
I like them. That was one of my primary pieces of beef with this.
I think those are so cool when they added that to automobiles. They've been around for a long, long time, but that tiny little triangle piece at the front edge of the window that opens to let vent.
It makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference. That's a great feature. And it wasn't for about, I think it was about 10 years later, when those officially kind of went away from cars. They didn't do that anymore.
The triangle's still there. It just won't open.
And then you look at the car, and then you realize, like, okay, this design car from, you know, this IDEA car from the 50s looks like a mid-60s design. So it was way ahead of its time. This is a pretty radically advanced car. Also had retractable seat belts in the front seats, which was pretty unusual for the day.
That is a really good point.
You know, just to have lap belts to begin with in 1953, that's pretty astonishing. But to be retractable seat belts was even more. And tiny little tail fins that were also integrated to the body. So I think I've got all those features out. So
those are a lot of great features. And now that we have told everybody about how swell this car is, maybe it's time to tell everyone why you don't know anyone who owns a Norseman.
Yeah, this is the really unfortunate part of this whole story. I mean, there's just no way to get around this. This is a bad ending for this vehicle.
Yeah, we need some like sea shanty shipwreck music.
Yeah,
for this.
And we have to go back to 1955, to really kind of describe where this whole chain of events that leads up to this started.
So it's 1955.
Yeah.
And the Norseman is scheduled to be one of the big tent attractions of the 1957 auto show circuit.
Yeah. Okay. So in 1955, and breaching into 1956, I guess, is probably the best way to say this because,
yeah.
You know, the car should have been done a month ahead of time, ahead of this. So it was supposed to be delivered around late May or early June of 1956.
Right.
And it was more than a month late when it was finally loaded onto an Italian passenger liner on July 17th, 1956. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that passenger liner was the SS Andrea Doria.
And just a few days later, on July 25th, 1956, Andrea Doria is heading to New York, and they're around 40 miles off the coast of Nantucket when, boom, the SS Andrea Doria collides with the MS Stockholm. They're in thick fog. The Stockholm's a Swedish passenger ship leaving New York. Out of 2,500 people, only 53 perished.
Yeah, 46 of those were on the Andrea Doria.
Right.
And the remainder were on the Stockholm. And the Stockholm was also an ice-breaking, it had an ice-breaking prow on it, I should say.
Right.
That just sliced right into the edge of, or the side of the Andrea Doria, and it right into, apparently, the garage area where the Norseman was located. It turns out that didn't necessarily matter a whole lot in the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the ship did go down about, took about a day, right? It floundered for about a day on its
side.
Yeah,
it floundered for more than 10 hours.
Which allowed a good deal of rescue effort because, you know, overall, from just the Andrea Doria, there were like something like 1,660 people that were rescued. Mm-hmm. But all the cargo was lost in that.
Yeah, they didn't have time to take all the cargo. Mm-hmm. And this meant that the Norseman was by no means the only car on this vessel.
No, there were several others.
It was specially packed, which did make a little bit of a difference, but the Andrea Doria eventually sank just there about 40 miles off the coast and went over 72 meters into the water.
Yeah, it's like 225 feet down, so it's a long way down. Mm-hmm. Into the cold Atlantic there. But you know, something else kind of interesting was happening at the same time, Ben. I don't know if you read into this or not, but mid progress across the Atlantic, I guess, when all this was happening. So remember, it was loaded on the 17th.
Yep.
It was about, and it was scheduled to arrive on, I think it was July 26th.
Right, yes.
The day it was supposed to arrive, and that was actually the day it sank. But on July 23rd, just 3 days earlier, Virgil Exner suffered a near-fatal heart attack.
Yep.
And it had nothing to do, because, you know, the wreck hadn't happened. It wasn't like a jolt, you know, shock to his, you know, system. He wasn't surprised by the news or anything.
Right, it was just bad timing.
Extremely bad timing that he suffered this horrible near-fatal heart attack
and
had to have open-heart surgery.
Survived.
Survived. He's in the hospital, and, you know, it was a couple of days later. You know, he knew about the wreck, of course. You know,
well, they didn't tell him at first.
Well, he's laying in his hospital bed, and I'm sure that, you know, the news is making its way to him. But
right.
They did tell him, finally, in his hospital bed, his wife and his son came to him and said, you know, Dad, I got some bad news about the Norseman. Mm-hmm. I went down with the ship. And it's just kind of an odd thing that, you know, he's laying in his hospital bed when he gets the news about this project that's been going on for years and years and years, and he's looking forward to it, you know, to seeing it for the first time. He hasn't seen it, really.
Yeah, 1956 is a rough year.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he gets this news, and honestly, it seems like he's okay with it because according to his son, he said, that's neat. One of my cars went down in a big famous shipwreck. It's like it was going to be immortal at that point, right?
Which sounds to me, when I initially read that, as though someone was on painkillers.
Okay. I understand what you're saying.
Not to be cynical, but, you know, maybe that's what happens when you narrowly survive something. You have to have open heart surgery. Your philosophy changes.
I understand. I get what you're saying. But also when you read that, you know, according to Virgil Exner Jr., he said that his dad was kind of romantically inclined like that. Like
right.
he was actually kind of excited by the idea that his vehicle, his Norseman, mm-hmm. was going to be forever remembered as the idea car that sunk with the Andrea Doria, forever, you know, to be forever held in this this watery grave, you know, that kind of thing.
He's a poetic dude.
He really was.
I respect that.
I do too. I think that was kind of a stand up reaction by him. I think.
Yeah, that was all class.
I mean, he could have been irate. You know, he could have just been breaking stuff and, you know, whatever. I mean, just been you know, flown off the hook.
And I've got the press release here for that Chrysler originally put out.
Because Chrysler had to somehow explain mm-hmm. that they're not going to have an idea car for the 1957 auto show circuit. How do they do that?
So they do it with this. Idea car lost on Andrea Doria. Detroit, July 26, 1956. A revolutionary new Chrysler Corporation idea car being shipped from Italy to the United States for its public debut was lost today in the sinking of the Italian liner Andrea Doria. Chrysler was advised by its New York shipping agent that since the ship went down in some 200 feet of water, the car must be considered a complete loss. The car was covered by insurance.
Nice. 1957 Newsman Reed as well.
Is that? Oh, well, thank you. I actually do have a 50s voice, but I'm not using it because I don't want to embarrass us
on
the air.
Taking us there anyways. I appreciate
but,
it.
So it remained.
And it's not the final chapter, though.
No, it is not.
There's quite a bit more that it goes on with this car, but there's a long gap. Yeah. I mean, you know, the ship is gone. The car is considered lost, you know, and, you know, honestly, Ben, due to, and I think that, had there been some more advanced methods of retrieving this
in the day
back in 1956, I believe they would have attempted to bring this thing to the surface immediately. I think that it was something that Chrysler or somebody would have gone after right away, but it just couldn't be done at the time. There just wasn't the technology.
Mm-hmm.
However, now there is. And some people have actually thought about this and actually made some moves to kind of start that process to resurface the Norseman.
Yes, there were divers who reached the wreckage the day after the collision,
mm-hmm.
And they came back with photographs, and they sold those to Life magazine.
Oh.
And there were other people who dived into the wreckage to, I don't want to say loot, but to investigate.
They're grabbing some souvenirs.
Yeah, a little bit of jewelry, you know, maybe see if there's any fancy stuff.
Some modern day treasure hunters.
Modern
day,
okay. That's a very nice way to say it. And then the way that we left this before the newest turn of events was, here's his name, was in the 1990s, David Bright, an explorer, a diver, he's down near the wreckage. He's looking for a lost diver. And he sees the Norseman for himself in the cargo hold. And he notes that, this is David Bright writing here, normally all passenger cars were placed in the garage section of the Doria that's slightly aft of the collision point where, as we said, the Stockholm knocked the Doria underneath the bowing bridge. These cars would have been placed in Doria by use of a crane, parked in the garage, arranged for stability.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Norseman was no passenger vehicle, so it was specially packed, treated with extra care, wooden crate, put in the number 2 cargo area.
Hmm, okay.
When he sees it, and keep in mind he's the last person really got a look at it at that point.
In the 90s.
Okay. So decades later. Mm-hmm. The crate had disintegrated. The car was in very, very poor condition. Salt water invaded the metal, most of the car's rust, corrosion, and a heap of indistinguishable junk. The tires are still there. And that's how they were able to identify it. The same way that, not to be morbid, the same way that they would identify people in a horrible tragedy by their teeth or something.
Yeah, sure. Whatever's left, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we've got to jump forward then.
Yes.
To there's actually an article about this if anybody wants to read more about it from the Hemmings Classic Car blog. I think it was in July of 2006.
Yep.
They had a feature on a guy named Joe Bortz. And Joe Bortz is from Highland Park, Illinois. He's a restaurant nightclub developer, and he's the owner of something that is called the Bortz Auto Collection. Mm-hmm. And you can check that online. I've already looked at that. It's pretty impressive. At the time, he had about 20 dream cars, Ben. He owns dream cars from the past, you know, these old relic cars that are worth quite a bit of money. He picked them up for very, very little money. But just as an example, like he had a 1954 Oldsmobile F88, which was a concept car, that sold for $3.24 million, and another one from 1954, a Bonneville Special, another Pontiac, or rather Pontiac, that sold for about $3 million. So his collection is worth an awful lot of money at this point.
Yeah.
He, at some party apparently, overheard somebody talking about the Norseman, or heard the rumors about it, I think.
Right.
That's it. He heard the rumors somewhere else, decided that, you know, maybe we can get that thing out of there at this point. You know, this is mid-2000s. You know, we've got to have some kind of technology to do it.
Right.
Well, I guess he was at some type of party in Chicago.
A soiree.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Exactly. And he actually agreed to pay a guy, already at this point, had agreed to pay a diver something like $20,000 to go look for the car and to determine how best to get this thing out of there, because he was already underway, knowing that, you know, it was going to cost him probably $500,000 to get this thing out.
Yeah.
Something
minimum,
like that. Maybe
right.
more. Yeah. But at this party, he talked to a chemist. And this chemist, who was a professor at a university, I guess, described to him, and he told him his plan. And the chemist said, you might as well abandon that plan. Because after this point, you know, that we're talking like now it's 57 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I don't know what era or what year exactly it was. But he said that at this point, the only thing left would be like the engine block, you know, some of the bigger chunks of metal, the tires, like you had mentioned.
Because of the corrosion.
And the glass, maybe. Maybe the glass. The glass might be intact, might not be. Depends on how violent, you know, it hit the ground when it went down. So, in other words, quest abandoned at that point.
There's nothing to save.
He gave it up. No, and this guy, this Bortz guy, there's an Auto Week article from 1990 that I found.
Mm-hmm.
And he found four of GM's Motorama Dream cars from the 1950s in a Detroit area salvage yard that had just been sitting out in the open rotting away.
What?
He found them, and he bought them for, you know, just a song, nothing. And they were spotted originally by some, like, this is so weird. A Ford engineer was flying overhead in a helicopter, looked down into the salvage yard, spotted a Motorama car,
mm-hmm.
an unusual car that it was sitting out in the middle of a field somewhere in this salvage yard. And then when he notified, or Joe Bortz heard about this, he went to look into it. You know, it's right there next to the GM Tech Center, which is north of Detroit, and the salvage yard is. And when he went there, he started looking around, and he realized there are three other GM Motorama cars from the 1950s there that were just rotting away. So he bought all four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Brought them back, restored them, and now, you know, these are the $4 million cars that we're talking about.
That's pretty crazy.
Amazing, isn't it? But they're out there to be had if you know what you're looking for.
We have to get to a junkyard.
It's incredible.
But before we get to a junkyard, we should tell the very last twist of this story so far.
Finally.
Yeah, Marty Martino. Who is he? What's he doing? Why did he come up?
This guy. He's somewhere in Virginia. That's all they'll say, right?
Yeah.
I don't know where he is. I mean, maybe there's more detailed information about him. But from the account that I heard, mm-hmm. this Marty Martino is a guy that he builds accurate, very accurate recreations of lost concept cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting right there, lost concept cars.
Yeah, we're talking – when we say very accurate, we're talking – what's the word? Verisimilitude?
Yeah. Yeah.
This may as well be the same thing.
Well, yeah, he does them with different materials.
At times necessity demands that, but one of my favorite facts about this guy, and you pointed out this guy when we were doing some of this research, one of my favorite facts about him is that the Kennedy replica, the Kennedy vehicles he built were so good that it's been used in, what, every Kennedy movie?
That's what basically. He claims. He says that car is used in every Kennedy movie ever since. You know, the 61 Continental X100, mm-hmm. The original, the true car is on display at the Henry Ford in Michigan. This is the one that they use for the movies.
Yes.
And it's so accurate that it's used in all the films. So, he's a great builder. He's a custom car builder. He's been doing it for decades.
Right.
Learned his trade, in fiberglass work when he was a boat builder. And eventually he built a Batmobile for a Z-Bart commercial that starred Adam West. So you can get an idea that, you know, this is pretty authentic, right?
Right.
Well, as you know, the Batmobile was based on the Lincoln Futura,
mm-hmm.
Which was a 1955 concept vehicle or dream car, idea car.
And we mentioned that one earlier.
Also lost because the only one of its kind, you know, the actual show car, which cost $250,000 to build, was sold to George Barris, you know, who created the Batmobile out of it. It was sold to him for $1,
mm-hmm.
you know, back in late 1950s after it had made the show circuit. So In other words, there is no Lincoln Futura from 1955 left over. It's
right.
the original Batmobile that George Barris created. He heavily modified it. You know, obviously, it wasn't worth anything to GM at the time.
Sure.
But now, you know, to have that car again, he's building a recreation. And he's also building a Chrysler Northman.
Yes.
And he is also building another one, a Pontiac Club de Mer, which I had never heard of. But, you know, all recreations, all very well done. You can check out Marty Martino's work online if you want.
Now, we haven't had too much recent news about Marty, but we are looking forward to it. So if you've heard something about some of the work that he's done, we would love to see a completed recreation.
Oh, very much, yeah.
Of the Norseman.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the Pontiac at the time was pretty close to being done. So
right, but the Norseman, if you check for his Norseman work, what you're probably going to see are some panel pieces at this point.
Yeah, he's got entire sides of the vehicle done that are kind of sitting on 2x4 stands, you know, that are recreated out of fiberglass, I believe.
Yes.
But very well done, and I think they're pretty accurate in the color of the vehicle, too, because it was kind of a green color.
Let's see, what do we got coming up, Scott? That's all I have on the Norseman.
Yeah, same here. I think we've pretty much extinguished this thing. But the legend, so, you know, just to wrap it up, I guess, the verdict on this legend is that it's absolutely true. The Norseman did go down with the Andrea Doria.
Mm-hmm.
It's still down there for anybody who would care to go take a look at what's left.
Pieces of it are down. You can dive down there. If you dive down to that depth, you probably have about 20 minutes to look around the wreck and explore. It's going to take you 90 minutes to come up safely without getting the bends.
Wow. Okay.
Stuff like that.
So is it worth it? Is a trip out there for that type of thing worth it? I think maybe because you know what?
It's an adventure.
It's a pile of rust at this point. I mean, literally like dust.
Yeah,
dust,
it's
rust.
More about the journey at this
point.
But
so few photographs were ever even taken of this thing because of that production rush in 1956. You know, they're trying to get on the boat of the finished vehicle. You know, when it was finished to when it sank, very few people ever saw this car in person, even the people that designed it, which is really, really unusual and had to have been just terribly frustrating for
them. Can you imagine you send off the drawings to Italy and you never see the car?
And it's done and you see the progress of it and then you
get photographs.
And you never get to see the final product. That would have been so frustrating to me. And so it's just an open end, you know?
Yeah.
It's never, never closed.
I'd also like to recommend some listener mail to you, Scott.
Sounds good.
All right, Scott. So Jason from Yellow Springs, Ohio, writes to us and says, "Hi, Scott and Ben. I just listened to the podcast called From the Ground to the Gas Pump, and on it you mentioned how while you're standing at the gas pump, it occurred to you how much of the pump itself is made from oil." Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. "I've had similar thoughts myself," says Jason. "Consider, if you will, how much of the car you're filling up is made from oil, including all the plastic, tires, lubricants, and fabric. Even some of the fabric you may be wearing is made from petroleum byproducts. You might also consider all of the petroleum that is used to run the factories that produce the raw materials for the products that go into your car and the distribution and delivery of the products themselves." That's a great point, but this is something kind of unrelated.
Okay.
It's a nice segue.
Mm-hmm.
"I'm an artist," says Jason, "and even the acrylic paints that I use are made from plastic, which is a petroleum byproduct. P.S., shameless plug, feel free to give out my website if you wish, and I'm going to do it. It's www.jasonmorganportraits.com. I checked out some of his portraits. It's really impressive stuff.
You know, I did the same. I went right to the motorcycle gallery.
Yeah.
and checked out some of those. Those are really cool. Some of the owners
well
and their
done.
Motorcycles.
Yeah.
And it's very well done. So good job.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's an interesting thought about the petroleum products and how much of that surrounds us all the time, everywhere that you go.
Yeah, and it's kind of, the email reminds me of Inception. Have you seen that movie?
Yeah.
Because it seems like we're going deeper. Consider the factories that make the product.
Yeah, exactly. And we're surrounded by petroleum products right now in our studio. We've got foam blocks on the wall for sound insulation. And, the clothes that we wear, the chairs that we're sitting in, everything. It's amazing.
This studio is pretty creepy, though, too. Compared to our older one.
You got that right.
All right, so we're going to, speaking of creepy studios, why don't we skedaddle out of this one now that we have proven the legend of the Lost Norseman.
Yeah, that's right. What a cool legend, huh?
Yeah, and we want to hear from you. If you have a missing car that you'd like to hear more about, drop us a line on Facebook. You can also drop us a line on Twitter, and we love to hear from people with any suggestions for upcoming topics. You can also send us an email. That's right, we still do old-fashioned email. Our web address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.